The program that I'm about to talk to you about is directly relevant to your conversation. It was very, very interesting and very exciting for me to listen to the discussion that you had the last few days. And it was also enriching to hear how significant the work that we're doing is, or at least what we think how significant it is. But I'm looking for your feedback as well. After you hear this presentation, after you come out and see the site at Fort McHenry, I'm interested in hearing what you have to say from a policy perspective on if this is actually a useful model, and if so, ways to then move forward with transferability. Basically, as an aquarium, we've taken a very significant step towards the stewardship of wetlands, of tidal wetlands in particular, and this is well beyond the five-year permit period. It's largely based on partnerships, federal, state, local government, private partnerships, but it's really based upon the institution's soul in trying to do more for a greater public that wants to do something. So it's both science-based and community-based. You know, so I'll talk about functional trajectory. I'll talk about performance standards. I want to hear from you, from a policy setting standpoint, what are the best performance standards? What is the right way to measure functional trajectory? And we'll take that information and employ that in the field and looking at these tidal wetlands here in the Chesapeake Bay region. We're doing restoration and maintenance, long-term data collection and monitoring, cultivating environmental leaders as we go, and developing things like field guides for community-based stewardship. The timeline here at this institution, as I mentioned yesterday, we're about 20 years old, and largely it's been one of education, and that's typically what you see from aquariums and zoos around the country. There's a solid base of education. Well, it hasn't been much more than 3 years since we've been doing a lot of action, conservation action, beyond typical captive breeding, things that zoos and aquariums have been known to do over the many, many years. But we were designated from Coastal America as a learning center. And there's no money from Coastal America. You may all have been aware of this federal agency, but there are a lot of conference calls and a lot of memos that fly by. And what this really has done for us is given us a chance to go to our board of governors and say, hey, look, we've committed to something with a lot of federal agencies that have signed on to give us this recognition. We need to do something. So it gave us the platform for which to develop this program. We continue to work with Coastal America. There is some very good access to higher levels in different federal agencies, and that can be of benefit. But other than that, there's no dollars, there's no access to dollars other than through standard grant procedures. When we talk about the Chesapeake Bay, we've got to make sure that we're talking to our audience effectively. And our audience largely is about the 6th to 8th grade reading level. So that's the kind of messaging, that's the kind of information that we're giving out. We all affect the bay, we can all help restore it. We talk about the enormity of the watershed, and all that goes on in that watershed directly affects the health of the bay. It's a very shallow estuary, and that the fact that the aquarium is taking steps to do more. Now, as we get deeper, we talk about the issues of dredging, and we talk about policy issues. But it was important for us, and I'll get into that in a minute, but it's important for us to establish a field station, a local field station. And in looking around the area, I felt there was no other place that was more appropriate, more perfect, than a site that was built about almost 20 years ago. It was designed, built about 17 years ago, and located at the end of this peninsula out here, and that's right adjacent to Fort McHenry. You can see from this aerial view, there's Route 95 that comes down. It actually goes underground in a tunnel, which you probably have all been in one point, and impacts related to the construction of that tunnel comes down mitigation. Part of that mitigation was done by that area, about 7 acres, right in the kind of lower corner of the screen. Now, there's an element of function that this site has that you don't often talk about, and that's public access and the use of this site as a potential educational tool. Well, that was never part of the design necessarily. It was more of a was historical presence of tidal wetlands in through here. In fact, during the War of 1812 at this fort interprets, They talk about the tidal wetlands in around that area. But this is a free national park site, a lot of parking. People can walk around, and that's about a 15-foot embankment up here. You have an amazing view of this tidal wetland for available to all the public. You'll see that today if you go on this field trip. But that, to me, meant what an opportunity. I say 10 acres, it's really 7, but there's a kind of adjacent upland and kind of associated offshore area that I look at as about a 10-acre footprint, located directly adjacent to Fort McHenry. It receives waters from about a 540-square-mile watershed, very, very urbanized watershed. The Gwynns Falls, the Jones Falls, the Patapsco. So what comes down those waterways? A lot of trash, in addition to other things. And because of the hydrodynamics of the Patapsco, this site in particular serves as kind of an eddy for that trash. So things really tend to raft up on this site. It was created 84-85 as mitigation. There was no permit requirements for long-term monitoring. There was no five-year, there was no performance standards. There was really no nothing. It was simply early enough that if it was green and growing, it was satisfactory. And there was a sense that, yes, this was a success, but there was no, as I say, long-term attention to this site beyond that initial construction period. So what we're looking at this opportunity, at this site, is in our minds a platform that we can really inspire action. We're looking at it from a watershed awareness standpoint, capacity building, looking at it in terms of wetlands and watershed health, looking at the issues of functions, but again, developing this model of maintenance management and improving design. What we can learn here hopefully can help future urban wetlands, urban tidal wetlands. Developing public participation models. You all have heard about public getting involved in these sites. There are ways we've learned that really help to engender and to increase long-term connection, not just a kind of a one-time shot out to a site, people picking up trash and that's it. How can we create that long-term stewardship, that sense of ownership of the site from a community perspective? And bringing up the issue of policy, the issue of no net loss, opportunities of wetland restoration, and looking at the Chesapeake Bay as a grand opportunity to look at the beneficial use of dredge materials, enormous amounts of dredging going on in the bay. In the state, there's restoration goals set by the Chesapeake Bay Program. There's also goals set by the Maryland, essentially the governor. That goal is a 60,000-acre goal. No timetable, but nonetheless, he's put together a wetlands restoration steering committee. And the goal is to kind of further these activities. There's a lot of challenges in this state. There's a lot of opportunities. And that goes beyond the regulatory elements of restoration and creation. And one of the ways to address this could be through elements of beneficial use of dredge material. There's 5.3 million cubic yards of maintenance dredging per year. And can disposal options and placement options be enhanced to the point that there can be kind of a win-win with wetland creation? But again, there needs to be long-term assessment of these sites to make sure that they're actually moving on that functional trajectory towards equivalency. And there's no real programmatic instrument for that through the state. Yes, there's support for beneficial use. Yes, there's support for projects. The Corps is very supportive of these opportunities. But beyond the construction phase, that's kind of where the projects end up ending. So getting back to the kind of the mitigation permit conditions, it's about generally 5 years here. With long-term maintenance and monitoring as part of that conditions, can we go beyond that? Can we establish a model, a community-based model that goes well beyond that, looks at functional trajectory, measuring those same performance standards over time? With this site itself, what we're looking at is improving the function. The site, as I mentioned, was built many years ago. And what has happened, when they first designed it, there were three large pipes that were to convey the hydrology back and forth. Well, those pipes, two of the three of them are completely silted up, and the other one has a lot of silt in there. And so essentially it's a big bowl, and water kind of sloshes in, especially at storm tides, then kind of stays in the site and slowly drains out. The next tide comes in, so there's not a lot of flushing at this site. So right off the bat, over time, and even something you really couldn't have measured in the first 5 years, over 15 years, there's been enough siltation that the hydrology has really significantly been modified. There's riprap surrounding the site, and a lot of those kind of interstitial areas have silted up as well. So it's a pretty rigid structure on the outside. There's also Phragmites. Now, it's not dominating the site. It's now the third in the level of dominance, but it's growing. It went up from about a 18% dominance to now about 22 just in the past 3 years of our monitoring, and that's with a targeted control attempt for about half of the site for the Phragmites. There's a tremendous amount of trash. We don't know how much that trash has affected the Phragmites invasion and the ultimate function of that site over time. We do know that we're out there at least 4, sometimes 10 times a year with hundreds of people picking this stuff up, and we've got enormous amounts of information about that, but we'd love to do a study on what that trash does to the function of that site. Does it beat down the native plants? Does that encourage colonization of frag? What is actually happening? Where does it go? Obviously, it would tend to go wrapped in the high spots. So that's a huge issue. Looking at this establishment of a long-term community-based monitoring and maintenance program, as I mentioned, sharing the results, getting the word out, not just locally, but to other zoos and aquariums. I mean, this is a model that other facilities like ours are interested in. There's a lot of talk about this, going beyond one's walls and working with the community. And again, increasing the awareness and public participation. We have great opportunities here in this building alone and through our website. One of the most important elements is getting the public involved at the planting stage. Now, that may be difficult, especially with mitigation, compensatory mitigation. That can be very difficult, and banks as well. But we know from doing some of these models that by getting the public involved at the beginning, at the planting stage, engenders connection. If they planted it, they're damn well going to be interested in coming out and monitoring it. So therein lies the opportunity. I would actually argue they're involved even earlier than this, at the design stage, that there could be some forum for public participation at the design stage. Now, again, that can be difficult, and there's a lot of issues relating to that that a lot of us may not want to get into. But having public involvement at the beginning is good. Having public involvement at the time of planting is fabulous and really is an opportunity that I would encourage everyone to consider if you want to go beyond the 5-year period with community involvement. So back to this field station. Another reason why that site is good for us is that it's close and we're able to access it very quickly and build in our minds a volunteer set of field supervisors, essentially the multiplier model. We're training people who, I want to do this. I want to do this a lot. I love doing this. I might work at, at local businesses or local government or whatever, or be retired, but I would really love to help you. Great. We have a program for that. As if you're a member of the aquarium conservation team, you go through a detailed briefing of what the restoration process is all about, how you do technical monitoring, going through all the procedures in the field, and what long-term maintenance is all about and why it's necessary. Plus, we train them to work with the public, the one-on-one. They're all first aid certified. Everyone has walkie-talkies when they're in the field. We can all communicate effectively. And it's a really important multiplier model. So we have 30 ACT team members on any given field event. I know 10 are going to show up. And that's really important to have that kind of commitment and you can count on. As I mentioned, public field days are really critical, not really for the monitoring aspects, but for the maintenance side of things. This is when we can really work with hundreds of people in any kind of weather and get them in the field and address the issues. And here, the issue that's most persistent is trash. Also Phragmites, and there's times to do that, but mainly it's trash. You can see the upcoming field days that we have. We just finished one on September 29th, just this last Saturday. We had about 85 people come out to the site. We go through a basic introduction and briefing for all the volunteers. Then we talk about restoration and maintenance. We go through some demos and then and also in some monitoring demos. But what they really do is get ready to go remove the trash. And with that, there's the debris removal, but also there's times of year when we're actually trying to remove the standing dead crop of frag, the stuff that we've either sprayed or done some kind of treatment to, removing that and taking that off. If anyone works at NOAA, there's Raleigh Schmitten there pushing that wheelbarrow, working very hard. Also monitoring the maintenance structure, the habitat structures. We put up well beyond, there was no habitat structures designed in the, but we've since worked with a local bird club to put in a lot of habitat structures for birds, and those require maintenance, and so we do that frequently. We have a nice monitoring path that you'll see as we go out today. We maintain that. And of course, trees and shrubs in the slope, there's a lot of maintenance involved in those as well, particularly during drought times. But again, the debris is the most significant aspect. In fact, there's Gary Mayer of the Restoration Center. Up trash. A lot of good presence by NOAA. In fact, from all of you from federal and state agencies, we encourage you to bring your staff down. We very much like to have full teams come down and participate in this, and NOAA's been a very, very good participant in that. Safety is a critical issue. Every time we're out there, we see about 100 syringes. And just imagine going in with a bunch of kids, digging in, hands digging into this crap, and, you know, you're going to get stuck. Therefore, we have a very, very strict protocol. We have these trowels that they use. See this guy with the blue gloves? In fact, they're both wearing, those are Kevlar-backed gloves on the palm and on the fingers. So even if you did put your hand in and the needle was there, you wouldn't get stuck. So it's really significant for us to have a very, very high, very detailed safety protocol. And again, I mentioned the studies needed on impact of vegetation. This is the kind of information we can generate. We've actually removed about 700 tons of material. A lot of that is kind of large docks that have just kind of floated ashore after a huge storm event. But enormous amounts of plastic. People who may just come out once are astounded by how much stuff they find. And I think their own patterns of where they put trash in the future is really affected. I mentioned the Phragmites, chemical and mechanical treatments. We cut it and remove it off-site. We're doing some test treatments of how best to address Phragmites control. As you've discussed, there's really no silver bullet to this stuff. It's just persistence, persistence, persistence. What you do see, the few remaining tidal wetlands that are around the Patapsco are 100% dominated by frag. And if we were to let this site go, I guarantee you, 20 years, it would be 100% frag. It's a very diverse site in terms of species. While the hydrology is not ideal at all, it's a great site in terms of its vegetation. It's great habitat. There's very, very few tidal wetlands in this area, natural or created, that are functioning as this one does, particularly in terms of bird, of avifauna use. So it's important that we address Phragmites. In some areas, I would argue, let the frag go. In this area, I'd say all-out blitz to try to control it. So, of course, we need young, sturdy, strong people to help us with this. So we've worked with the Eagle Scouts and the Girl Scouts as well, but the Eagle Scout project through the Boy Scouts of America has been a really great opportunity working with groups of kids to really address this issue. And they come up with a plan. We give them the set of parameters. They set the plan up. They implement the plan with their fellow members of their troop, and we can really work with them to monitor the effectiveness of this and track hours, labor, which is pretty significant when you're looking at frag eradication. Revegetation of the site, as I say, this is largely on the side slopes, but inside that marsh itself. Once we do frag removal, we're looking at species that can grow well in that same area. And in this particular case, Spartina sinusoroides, the big cordgrass, is an ideal native plant that does very, very well where frag has been removed from. And then we monitor their survival. When we work with the volunteers, of course, we go through very detailed safety tips, and I mentioned that. And you can see the kind of grouping of about 10 to 15 people per ACT team member. So no one field supervisor has too many people. It's a kind of controllable group. In terms of the monitoring, in terms of looking at the functional trajectory, of course, critical is finding a good local reference site. And there really isn't a great local reference site here in the Patapsco. We have a site both down in Magathy and one further up in the gunpowder system. And those are great. Those are good natural sites that have the same kind of diversity as you'd expect in this system. But there's really not a good, in this particular watershed or this tidal tributary, a really solid reference site. I would argue what we really need is a lot of attention to establish what the reference conditions are in certain areas of the bay. Maybe there's four key reference areas that we could study intensively and say, yes, these are the conditions at these areas, therefore we can begin to set performance standards over time. Of course, looking at the hydrology, the whole water budget, tidal inflow, outflow, storage, groundwater, well, there really isn't a whole lot that we think of an effective groundwater at this site, but we're working with USGS, their local team here, to establish that to see if indeed that is true. I'm working with NOAA and the co-ops program on establishing tidal datums because there is sea level rise, particularly here in the bay. It's up to about over 4 millimeters per year, so establishing exactly where you're measuring mean low-low is critical. Continuing to do the detailed topography, as sea level is rising, are these tidal wetlands keeping up? And that's a key, in my mind, a key research question. If we're going off and creating a large-scale sites, particularly with beneficial use, will these things keep up? Will there be an organic component that keeps these things moving, or sediment accretion that keeps these things going up, especially in terms of elevating sea level rise? What's happening with the vegetative structure, and again, faunal utilization? So as we look at certain goals at the site, looking to establish performance standards for the hydrology, of course, and again, we're working with USGS to do that. Now, this is an opportunity that we have with the Port Administration here in Maryland. Now, they're part of the Department of Transportation. They both do and work with the Corps to do dredging, but they also have impacts that relate to tidal wetlands. What we're doing is working with the Port and with MDE on establishing partnerships that are either tied potentially to some kind of mitigation or not. And in fact, we've worked independently with MDE on establishing some of these basic sampling protocols so that we can look at creative ways of taking this model and furthering it at certain areas, and particularly starting right here with the mitigation site at Fort McHenry. So with this, looking at ways of improving the hydrology, setting up performance standards of how that site should flush, preparing the detailed construction drawings, implementing the construction, if there are impacts, which there will be, to vegetation, and we will target the Phragmites during this construction process, do the extensive revegetation, and then long-term post-construction monitoring. I mentioned sea level rise. This gives you some information over the past 70 years of sea level rise trends. This is Lower Bay, but it's pretty similar up here. It's about 4.2 millimeters per year of sea level rise. And again, I mentioned that didn't transfer well, the information on this, but establishing tidal datums, very, very important to establish mean low low as you begin to look at topography. And that would be the kind of model that we would set up for a monitoring of a site like this, looking both at upland transition zone and marsh vegetation, establishing where that mean low low is, putting in the tide gauge, and then establishing several cross sections as we go through the site to look at how well it accretes and keeps up over time. From a habitat standpoint, fish utilization and bird utilization are critical. And so, yeah, the site may be green and growing, but is it really useful as habitat? When we went to address this, well, we have great ornithologists upstairs in our rainforest, we knew we couldn't depend on them. They work here. In fact, they work their tails off keeping the birds here happy. So we knew in order to address this issue, we needed to go out into the community and go to the Baltimore Bird Club, which made all sorts of sense. And they're part of the Maryland Ornithological Society, and they helped us establish historical census. There was a guy actually at Fort McHenry who was a surgeon back in the late 1800s who established, he was just an active birder, so in his spare time he'd go out and he'd track the birds that flew into the area. He had a species list of 270 species that he tracked at that time. That's 120 years ago. That gives us a benchmark of which to then measure how this particular site is doing. We've already seen, and we've begun this is now just beyond 2 years, 179 species of birds. And I have a detailed list here if anyone's interested in it. And we just added a new record this last week for the state of Maryland. Has anyone ever seen a great white heron? Those from Florida? Yep. They're a color morph of the great blue heron. They're thought to live entirely right around the Keys. But we saw one and positively confirmed one last Tuesday. I saw it myself on Saturday. And it's likely, not guaranteed, but that it'll be out there today. And so we'll check that out. So for those of birders out there, you may add one to your life list. But look at the individuals tallied. We also do some mist netting and banding. And again, habitat enhancements, working to make sure that this site is functioning very, very well. We do a lot of water quality and weather monitoring. We're not measuring the water. Well, we are doing some water quality measurement inside the tidal wetland, but we're using the site to look at the quality of the water of the Patapsco itself. And from there, talking about watershed issues. We're following the exact same protocol as the NERS, the National Estuarine Research Reserve sites, doing rapid long-term monitoring. Every 15 minutes, that YSI Datasonde is taking a snapshot of DO, pH, chlorophyll A, salinity, conductivity, and others. We're also doing a nutrient contaminant suite. We're working with NOAA on this, and we're also providing this as a great opportunity for students. And this opens up a lot of academic partnerships. We work with regional universities. They follow the exact same protocol, which if any of you have ever played with the NERS stuff, it's very, very detailed. They actually, as students, with their own hands, calibrate, download, analyze the information. We're targeting minority-serving institutions. If you look around just this room, it's a kind of deplorable, the lack of diversity in this field. And so we're trying to address that at the college level. And also we feel with this kind of training, in fact, we know the NERS sites have said, listen, if you have any students who finish this program, we'll take them because there's such a need to have this kind of training for them to just jump right on in. It takes about 6 months for people who go to NERS sites to kind of get up and running and functional, and that there's actually a lot of turnover because there's some frustration involved in that process. Well, this didn't translate well either on the burning process, but we generate data sets. Now, these data sets are good, and we can talk to the students about them, but if we're to share this information with the public, which we really want to do, how the bay is doing right now, we can't give this kind of information. We have to do it in a somewhat creative way. But the students, they can use it, and they can come up with really nice diagrams of what's going on. So this is temperature combined with dissolved oxygen. Warm temperatures with rain events, excess nutrients create hypoxic conditions. Simple stuff, but this is information that they've gone out and they've essentially generated themselves with these pieces of equipment. In order to translate this information to a broad public, we're looking at the use of GIS, particularly ARC-IMS. It's got to be very simple, Watershed 101. We feel it needs to support local community-based watershed restoration and watershed association activities, supporting multimedia CD-ROM products, targeting, again, sixth grade level, strong partnerships with many federal agencies, funding through the EPA's MPACT program, which last I heard that was zeroed out of the budget, unfortunately. And this is the kind of thing we'll be generating. It's a really simple web-based approach to how the bay is doing. Simply delineating watershed within political boundaries, being able to drill into that watershed, learn a little bit more about the different layers, and then going in a little further to see, oh yeah, okay, now I see where you're talking about. This is where you're measuring the water from. There's that yellow dot is the site. And then we'll have dials, really simple dials that will show you how the water is doing and why we care, why this information is even important at all. In our minds, all of this is transferable. It's transferable throughout the bay. It's transferable throughout the country. And so, as I mentioned earlier, with the whole opportunities for beneficial use, the islands in the Chesapeake Bay are extraordinarily important in terms of their habitat value themselves, but also on the leeward side of these islands, they protect hundreds and hundreds of acres of SAV beds, of seagrass beds, essentially. There is enormous need for placement sites. the governor and the dredging needs and placement options folks have put a lot of these islands on a kind of a targeted list, demonstrating innovative technology, use of geotubes, other coastal engineering strategies, strong federal partnerships. What we're saying is, hey, there needs to be a community-based approach, science-based approach, if we want to understand how well these sites do over time. That one didn't work. There's another view of the site. You can see all those dots behind that island. Those are all seagrass beds. And you can see also the dredging that goes on an annual basis, just simply to access. That accesses Fishing Bay, and that's Barren Island in front of you. And it's part of National Wildlife Refuge system, part of the Blackwater. In fact, there's John Gill, the refuge manager, who's now has his own Chesapeake Bay Islands unit. So this is the Fish and Wildlife working with the Corps on saying, all right, you need dredge placement. I've got an island that could really benefit from placement of material. No, that's too bad. These are all shots, very, very creative shots of the restoration process. Yeah. Incredible. Transferability to the big X, you know, it's all about the drop zone. No, but there's a serious, there's a series of islands that are in need of this kind of work. Eastern Neck National Wildlife Refuge, Poplar Island, which many of you may have heard of, Watts Island, Bodkid, Smith Island, even here in the Patapsco, there's great opportunities to take dredge material, clean dredge material, and build up to create tidal wetlands. The tyranny of the X's right here. So this does indeed include long-term monitoring and maintenance as well, replanting, vegetative analysis, faunal observations, detailed topography, nice shot of Poplar Island, beautiful shot of Poplar Island. And here's a great shot of our seagrass restoration. And those of you who saw the seahorse exhibit downstairs, you may have seen a little bit of information that seahorses live in the Chesapeake Bay. A lot of people don't know that, which is one important issue. Secondly, seahorses are tied to habitat. Its habitat is tied to water quality, and water quality is tied to us. So we're trying to make that distinct linkage. When water quality improves and when really detailed homework has been done on site selection, then there can be targeted approaches to restoration. We know we've had a lot of failures with seagrass restoration. However, when there is good water quality, there's historic presence of seagrasses in an area, and there's long-term protection from a water quality standpoint, there could be a good opportunity to do some targeted on-the-ground transplanting, and that's what we're doing in conjunction with many, many partners, largely funded by NOAA. There's some other private foundations have been supporting this, and working at Langley Air Force Base at the very tip of their runway, which is interesting to see these F-15s all loaded up fly right overhead. But it's a really incredible partnership. And there's the opportunities of partnerships. And I think what you'll find is when these community-based models happen, everyone wants to get a piece of them. The media jumps all over it. I mean, you may be working on a mitigation site for years. You'll get no media attention. Suddenly you get a group of kids out there, and there's a TV station and a radio station wanting to know what's going on. Great opportunities just for media, but also getting the public, the federal agencies, to work and talk together, as you've all noted. In fact, I think right at the beginning of this, you noted that as a very significant need. And what we've been able to serve as is this kind of non-federal agency. We're a private 501c3 nonprofit, but we've been able to serve as a kind of a easy partner, I guess, to federal agencies, state agencies, local government, to work together. And this may be, as I say, transferable. There's zoos and aquariums all over the country, and maybe in your jurisdiction there's a couple that could benefit from something like this. Again, it's community-based. It's all about the people coming out and feeling like they have an ownership in doing some of this, but working with good, solid science, making sure that the work that they're doing is used, that it actually makes a difference, and that they're cared for in kind of all the right ways. So that pretty much sums it up. I encourage you to, if you would like, to come with us on the tour. We'll be meeting. We have to leave pretty much right at 3 from there's a little water taxi dock right out here in front, right beyond the submarine. So we'll need to leave there right at 3. We'll zip over to Fort McHenry. It's about a 15-minute cruise by water taxi. We'll get out, we'll walk the site. We'll actually not get in the marsh itself. We'll kind of walk above it on a monitoring path. I'll show you the weather station, the water quality site, talk about some of these issues, maybe see that great white heron. And then we'll zip back here, and we should be back here by 4:15,
4:30, please.
Nope, you guys are all fine in terms of how you're dressed. If anyone is would like assistance going up or downstairs, let me know. We can make that happen. But it'll be very, very, very easy in terms of what you're wearing. Or we could take the other way and go over the riprap.